This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Andrew Miller, staff writer for the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thank you for joining us on the Trumpet Hour. Our panel of trumpet writers is eager and ready to discuss the most important events of the week. Here in the studio with me, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you. I'll be discussing the new government in Taiwan and how their refusal to kowtow to China the way the previous government did could lead to a drastic change in the status quo in Asia.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be here. I'll be talking about Iran and their moves across the Middle East, especially concerning how that affects Israel.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. I'll be talking about an evil group of shape-shifting lizards, as well as something described as an incredibly potent danger.
All right. We look forward to that. And also joining Mr. Palmer in Britain, we have Mr. Sam Livingston.
Hello. Today I'll be talking about America's $1.7 billion payment to Iran back in January and how Iran is now using that money.
Sam is one of our key researchers for Mr. Stephen Fleury's Trumpet Radio Show, also broadcast here on KPCG and posted on thetrumpet.com. As an American living in Anglo land, he will be taking my usual spot covering Anglo-American news for today's Trumpet Hour. On the show, we try to give a broad view of important news all over the world. The Trumpet is based in the United States, but we have staff in the United Kingdom, in Jerusalem, in Australia, which watch every corner of the world and assemble the most prophetic and significant news for our audience. But in today's show, we're going to put a particularly special emphasis on the news behind the news, the significant stories that the big media outlets, in the United States at least, refuse to cover. We are seeing the major effects of these stories all over the world. And so today we're going to start off with a big story that's not got much coverage out of Germany. There have been three German cabinet ministers, a U.S. senator, a former president of the European Commission, and well over 100 other top political and business leaders from across America, Canada, and Europe that are meeting in Dresden, Germany today for a geopolitical conference. Despite the fact that there's members of the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post as invited attendees to this conference, they've all promised not to report on its internal discussions. So to help give us some idea of what's going on here, we're going to turn to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, we're going to talk about the Bilderberg meeting. This is a subject that, to be quite frank, I hate talking about because it's something that always really does appeal to the kind of tinfoil hat crowd. It's something that has become so heavily associated with kind of crackpot conspiracy theorists like the evil shape-shifting lizards that I alluded to at the start. It is kind of hard to have a proper rational discussion about it. But that's what we're going to do today. I mean, it's something that when you mention it, a lot of normal, proper, rational thinking people kind of tune out and you get the crazies come in.
Right.
But it is a real thing, the Bilderberger meeting. It is a meeting of influential leaders that take place. You covered some of the people that will be attending there just now. There'll also be quite a lot of people associated with the European Union there, like European Commission President José Manuel Barroso or former president. Henry Kissinger, I believe, was scheduled to go there. The director of the IMF, Christine Lagarde. Ursula von der Leyen will be there from Germany. Wolfgang Schäuble, so some of the most important and influential German politicians. And we have an article about it in Trumpet Weekly this week. And this article, it does a great job of ignoring the conspiracy and weird elements around it and just focusing on the facts. And I'm not just saying that because it was written by our host today. So it has been an important meeting in the past. I'll just quickly quote from it quickly. It was founded by Prince Bernhard and Joseph Rettinger to primarily to drum up transatlantic support for the United States of Europe. And then this article goes on to talk about a paper Richard J. Aldrich and a book that he wrote talking about the American backing for Europe. I actually read Aldrich's work about last month, because he did do a lot of great work just focusing on how hard America worked to create the European Union and how to persuade Britain to join it. And the Bilderberg group was one of the key vehicles that America used to help persuade European officials to get in line with this European project.
Right. That is seems like so much news that covers it tries to just pan it off as like some sort of secret society like the Illuminati and the Freemasons. And while they are secretive, I mean, it's not a secret society. Everybody knows when they meet, where they meet, who's on their guest list, and even a rough...
They have a website.
They have a website and even a rough list of what they're going to talk about. But why the secret? Why is it that this group doesn't want to publish their notes of these meetings?
I think it said that the discussion is under Chatham House rules, which generally means people can report on the discussions but not attribute any quotations to anybody in particular. So I think it's just there to, I mean, these are big influential businessmen. They don't want to see their name plastered all over the front page with something they've said. And so by having Chatham House rules, which is fairly standard, I think, for these kind of meetings, it allows much freer discussion.
Right. So I guess they're probably trying to avoid like sound bites they get in the media, quotes taken out of context. It would be a big push for this. And then maybe even trying to keep some of the more discussions away from the public eye. I'm not sure if maybe we reported on this in the past, because I know they're saying a big thing of this meeting agenda this year is obviously Britain's referendum to leave the European Union, which... according to another Trumpet contact, Mr. Rodney Atkinson, he's even attributed that some of the influence of influential Bilderberg members to the downfall of Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s.
Yeah, they are touching a lot. They're talking about the biggest issues of the day here and things that are very emotional issues. You mentioned Brexit and Britain. I think they also published that the immigration crisis was on the agenda. If someone like Wolfgang Schäuble was to say something in public on the immigration crisis, he'd be guaranteed to make most of the front pages in German newspapers. So they are talking about big, important events and things that have a lot of emotional resonance.
Yeah, it will definitely be something to keep a close eye on. I know they usually invite some of these key journalists, even like Anne Applebaum from The Washington Post, or some of these key journalists, so that they have an inside scoop, almost kind of in return that they let them come to the meeting in return for their guarantee to not publish some of these internal discussions. But
and people like Anne Applebaum, she's a pretty influential thinker within the foreign policy establishment. She's married to the former Polish foreign minister. So they're people who can help form discussion and help form opinion. And so you talked about, the Bilderberger had meetings. They have had agendas in the past. They have pushed for example, Britain joining the European Union, going back a few decades. And so having some of these influential thinkers at the meeting who communicate to the public can help them advance those objectives.
Right. And I know a lot of those influential thinkers really drum up the idea that there needs to be a united Europe, and that united Europe needs a close alliance with the United States to build like a Western power block to oppose Russia and China. And a big problem of that is sometimes you get some of these, like the European Union's very anti-democratic, very behind the scenes working, that you almost start, in your efforts to oppose China, you almost start becoming China in terms of like your government technocratic regulations. But that is a big driver, is to oppose China, which will be a huge part of our next story. So thank you for bringing that to us, Richard. And now to give us a little bit more information on another disturbing story coming out of Russia this week, which might give some context as to why there's such a concern across Europe and America about opposing this rising Russian-Chinese power bloc, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yes, Russia and America are in possession of the two largest nuclear arsenals in the world. They each have thousands of nuclear weapons. But back in 2010, the two nations agreed that they would both pare down those arsenals, scale them way back, and reduce the number of weapons and deployed weapons that they each have. And this was a landmark deal called the New START Arms Treaty. The treaty called for both Washington and Moscow to pare down their nuclear arsenals to 700 deployed land-based and sea-based missiles, and then to reduce their numbers of deployed warheads to 1,550. So it was something that people in the West really celebrated when this deal was hatched. And they said it meant a safer world for everyone, fewer nuclear weapons, so everyone would be safer. And the United States was quick to do its part, and Russia was quick to do its part too, and everyone lived happily ever after. Except that's not what actually happened. The U.S. really did reduce its weapons to the agreed numbers, but this week a bombshell report was released by the inspectors who traveled to Russia to verify that they had performed the reductions that they said they have performed. And the inspectors found some really troubling evidence showing that the Russians are not in compliance with this START treaty and that they've been really actively trying to deceive the inspectors. First, they found that critical components of the nuclear missiles were unbolted rather than severed. So this means that rather than being permanently disabled, the sophisticated nuclear weaponry could quickly be brought back online in the event of a conflict simply by rebolting those components. And then the inspectors were also unable to verify that a whole cache of missiles that were marked for elimination and that the Russians said had been eliminated had actually been destroyed. So the START treaty requires that these measures be verifiable. That's one of the most emphasized aspects of the treaty. So the fact that the inspectors could not verify it in itself was a violation of the treaty. But even more worrying is that these nuclear missiles are out there somewhere, apparently deployed or stored in places that the U.S. has no knowledge of. And the Russians just say, yes, they're gone. We destroyed them. I'm sorry that you can't verify that. The only thing that the inspectors were able to find to inspect in this area were missile launch canisters. And after this troubling discovery, one of those inspectors said, Russia will meet their treaty elimination goals by using empty launchers from retired and retiring missile systems. They're basically cutting up launchers that don't even carry missiles. So this is a really troubling revelation. It shows that those who rejoiced when the Obama administration entered into this treaty with the Russians back in 2010 were hasty and naive. And the truth is that the Russians are deceiving the United States. And the reason they're doing it is because they're sure that the current administration in America won't really take any serious action against this kind of deception.
Yeah, it's just an amazing revelation. Really, really effective strategy on the Russian parts. Trick your main rival into it. Dearming themselves, their nuclear arsenal, while you secretly keep yours intact. I mean, I'm sure Chairman Khrushchev in the Soviet days wishes he would have thought of that. But on second thought, I'm sure probably most of the American administrations in the Soviet days were quite naive enough to just give up their entire reduce their nuclear arsenal that much.
That's right.
A blind faith that the Russians would follow suit.
Yes. Yeah, it's you have to have a dangerous level of naivety to just assume that the Russians will comply. I've got a really sobering quote here from the House Armed Services Committee Chairman, Mac Thornberry. And he's basically saying that this new revelation is just one small part of a broader problem of the Obama administration refusing to really press Russia to adhere to its various treaty obligations. Mr. Thornberry said, whether it's Russian violations of the Open Skies Treaty, the Biological and Chemical Weapons Conventions, or multiple violations of the INF Treaty, this administration has proven singularly unconcerned with arms control compliance. Never having been made to pay the price, why wouldn't Vladimir Putin conclude that violations of the New START Treaty would go unpunished as well?
It makes perfect sense from Vladimir Putin's part. So it's just a shocking revelation. So definitely thank you for bringing that to us. You've been listening to The Trumpet Hour, our week in review program here on 101.3 KPCG. And Russia is not the only major world power trying to build up its own atomic arsenal. There's another disturbing revelation of an arms buildup in the Middle East that according to reports coming out this week, that American taxpayers may be inadvertently funding. And to bring this story to us, we'll turn to Sam Livingston.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. You'll remember back in January, almost immediately after the Iran nuclear deal was implemented, the United States and Iran had a prisoner swap. So I'd just like to give a little bit of context into this prisoner swap, because it was really overshadowed because of the coincidental timing of this swap. So essentially, five Americans that were captured in Iran, the Iranians accused them of espionage, were traded or swapped for seven Iranian prisoners who were charged or convicted by the United States. So this swap is going on in the midst of this deal, and you really didn't hear a whole lot about it afterwards. And then right alongside the announcement of this prisoner swap, the United States says it's going to pay Iran $1.7 billion to settle what White House spokesman Josh Earnest said was a long-running claims process. And what that process was essentially back in the 70s when the Shah of Iran was leading there, they wanted to buy some weapons from the United States, so they opened up this fund, and they put $400 million into this fund to buy weapons. Now then in 1979, the Iranian Revolution occurred. Iran never got their weapons, and they never got their money back. So that money was kind of in limbo for the last 35 years. And it just so happens that the United States, right around the time of the announcement or the implementation of the nuclear deal, decides we're going to pay Iran back this money. And it wasn't just the $400 million U.S. dollars that was in this account. The United States decided we're going to pay interest. And that interest amounted to $1.3 billion U.S. dollars. So in total, the United States government, money that was paid by U.S. taxpayers, paid Iran $1.7 billion. And there was a lot of speculation at the time that this payment was viewed as a ransom for this prisoner swap.
Right, this happened the day after, so you could see how people would think that.
Yeah, of course. So like I was saying, the timing is what is just hilarious here, that you have this 35-year-long dispute and you decide, okay, well, we'll implement the nuclear deal. Oh, and now it's time to pay back this debt. So with the ransom point here, here's what the Wall Street Journal wrote the day after. A senior Iranian military official has publicly stated that the clearing of the $1.7 billion was a key factor in Tehran's decision to release the imprisoned Americans. And this is what that military general in Iran said. He says, taking this much money back was in return for the release of the American spies and doesn't have to do with the nuclear talks. So flat out saying, look, this was a huge part of us deciding to go ahead with this prisoner swap. And again, you didn't hear much about it afterwards. So the United States goes ahead, wires this money to Iran. Next question, well, what does Iran do with it? And this is what Eli Lake wrote in his latest article for Bloomberg View. He says, for months it was unclear what Iran's government would do with this money. But last month, the mystery was solved when Iran's Guardian Council approved the government's 2017 budget that instructed Iran's central bank to transfer the $1.7 billion U.S. dollars to the military. So we're already getting a foretaste here of where this money is going to be going. It's going right into funding Iran. Obviously, we hear a lot with these nuclear talks about, well, we have to keep Iran from getting the bomb. Meanwhile, they're wreaking all sorts of havoc throughout the Middle East. And in essence, the United States is funding this in a way.
Given almost $2 billion to the Iranian military to use to fund a proxy war in Syria, when American taxpayers are also paying to give arms to the rebels on the other side. So, I mean, in a sense, it's no wonder we have so much debt. We're funding both sides of a civil war in the Middle East.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is just, it's a black hole, really. You're just paying each side. I mean, you're fighting for one side, you're paying them, and then, well, you're funding the enemy. So it's this perpetual war that we just are funding in that sense. Just continuing on here with sort of the reaction from the Obama administration. Again, the timing of this story is what made it so unique was that, well, this is, in essence, we're just trying to put this right alongside the nuclear deal. Hopefully that covers it up. The Obama administration argued that, well, paying this $1.7 billion was a huge break for the United States because we went ahead and decided to make our own interest rate, essentially, rather than having the host country where that fund was set the interest rate, which the Obama administration says, well, that interest rate would have been much higher. We would have had to pay more money if we did it when the host country said to do it. Now, the thing, again, about this, it's been 35 years. That host nation where the money was wasn't pressing the United States to do this. So out of the blue, the Obama administration says, it's time to pay this back. This is the interest we're going to give you, and this is a break for U.S. taxpayers because eventually we'd have to pay it and pay a lot more. So they're arguing that, well, this is great that we went ahead and that we gave them this money when we did. So I'd just like to read one more bit from Eli Lake's article. He says, the irony here is that Iran has been pleading poverty in recent months. The country's supreme leader and foreign minister have publicly complained that Iran's economy has not seen the benefits expected from the Iran nuclear deal. And yet, Iran's 2017 $19 billion defense budget has increased by 90% from 2016. And then he concludes, we know where $1.7 billion of that came from. So almost doubling their defense budget. And like you said earlier, they're fighting us in Syria. They're countering our interests in the Middle East. And largely this is being funded, well, not largely, I should say, but a good chunk of this is being funded by the United States. And not even to mention what sort of incentive that gives Iran to go ahead and take in more captives if they know that the United States is going to work really hard to try and befriend them, to try and stay on good terms with them by giving them money in this way.
So, right, and it would just encourage them to take more more hostages in the future. It's just an amazing amount of money and an amazing revelation. So yeah, definitely thanks for bringing that to us. You've been listening here to the Trumpet Hour on KPCG 101.3. We'll have one more story before the break. And this story will give us some additional usages to the specifics on Iran's military goals in the Middle East and how they may put that $1.7 billion to use. And for that, we'll turn to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Brent.
This article that we're going to talk about, it's written by Caroline Glick, and we do focus a lot on her. She writes for the Jerusalem Post every Friday and some Tuesdays. And actually, the day that this article came out, myself and Brad McDonald, another trumpet writer, were at the Tel Aviv airport, and we were coming through the parking lot in our car where you have to pay and the little boom gate goes off so you can leave. And there was Carolyn Glick right there paying for her car to leave the airport. We tried to slow her down and say good article, but she drove right past us. But nevertheless, she did write a really insightful article here. And there's one that we tried to get into the Trumpet Weekly last week, but it came out on Friday, so there wasn't that much time. But it's really worth a read because it details Iran's strategy throughout the Middle East. And instead of, it's from the Israeli perspective, she's Israeli. And usually when Israel focuses on Iran, they tend to focus on what they're doing in the immediate vicinity, whether it be sponsoring Hamas in the Gaza Strip or even trying to infiltrate the West Bank with Hamas, one of their proxies, or even Hezbollah to the north and what Iran is doing with Hezbollah. And yet what she does in this article is really castigates the Israeli defense forces and the thinkers in Israel because they don't put the whole strategy of Iran together. She calls it the chessboard, whereby the events that take place or what Iran is doing in Iraq or what Iran is doing in Syria is actually having everything to do or will have everything to do with what it wants to do in Jerusalem with Israel as well. So she details this in a number of different ways. Specifically, she talks about the rise of the Islamic State and then the way that Iran has really led the fight against the Islamic State and how much that is leading to a situation where Iran is gradually creeping over the Middle East, across the Euphrates, into Iraq, across the Tigris, and then into Western Iraq and Syria, getting really close to Israel's border.
Right. Yeah, she does. Her analogy of a chess match is very apt in that you can just see just all these pieces that this is definitely requires some central planning. And of course, the U.S. State Department, they know all this, which makes it all the more shocking that they're willing to throw a couple billion dollars at them now and again to when their budget gets low. But yeah, definitely. Thanks for bringing that to us, Brent. We'll be back to you right after the break. Coming up, we'll be talking on terrorist attacks in Tel Aviv, America's Achilles heel, the educational system in Taiwan, and why Senator Bernie Sanders just won't go away. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
All right, welcome back to Trumpet Hour. Our editorial department is currently getting ready to publish an updated version of our editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury's booklet, The King of the South. It'll really just outlines all the like geopolitical nuances of the Middle East and how they're prophetically and biblically significant. So hopefully we'll have that out and published by the end of the summer, because just the rise of radical Islam just really is shaping the entire world scene. And one event this week that just kind of really illustrates just how prevalent some of these terrorist violence is becoming in the Middle East is just a heart-rending attack that happened in Tel Aviv this week. And for that story, we'll go back to our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
Yeah, this Wednesday night, this past Wednesday night, I'm sure most people have heard, at least local time at 9 p.m., a couple of seemingly normal people dressed up in nice black suits, black ties, walked into a Tel Aviv restaurant or ice cream parlor and basically sat down. Well, they ordered something first, and then they sat down, and about 15 minutes later, they stood up and started shooting indiscriminately against different Israelis. It doesn't look like they had anyone specifically targeted. This was just a blatant terrorist attack on civilians right inside Tel Aviv's one of more of the more popular districts there, where a lot of tourists and locals go. One of the old markets is there. We were just there. Some of our representatives over here were a block away from this location just a day earlier from this attack. So it's not one of those places that you would consider dangerous. It's not like you're in the old city of Jerusalem. It's not like you're by the Damascus Gate or even in East Jerusalem, where a lot of these things happen. But here it was in the middle of Tel Aviv. And it does have a lot of the Israelis and intelligence services a little worried about how these Palestinian men from the West Bank got into Israel proper, how they got to Tel Aviv, why weren't they caught at a checkpoint, and then how they can carry these type of arms on them. Now, Tel Aviv isn't as loaded as Jerusalem, and by that I mean a lot of Jerusalemites, they will carry guns, concealed guns on them, and they can take down a terrorist rather fast if a terrorist starts to attack somebody. And yet in Tel Aviv, it doesn't seem, there wasn't any security guard at this restaurant. And they're talking about the security situation in this mall for why it happened or how they could let this happen. But it just shows what the Palestinians are willing to do to, I don't know, cause more violence against Israelis, willing to just take out random citizens.
Right. They're probably more prepared for those things in Jerusalem, just because there have been so many similar attacks like this there. I mean, Tel Aviv is it's a rough city as well, but they generally, it probably doesn't get as much public limelight, but so they might not be as ready for these things. But it just must be so hard to try to police an entire country like that, to try to prevent stuff like this from happening, when you've just really just got this anti-Semitic, hate-filled ideology against people who aren't even connected with the Jewish government, but just
right. It is very difficult faith, when you get to Tel Aviv. Like you say, they just aren't prepared as well with the security apparatus that they are in Jerusalem and other even West Bank towns, West Bank settlements. So we'll see what happens. I mean, Ramadan just started. The holy month of Ramadan started on Monday night, I think at midnight. And this was some of the social media were talking about how these guys broke their fast, where you fast during the daylight portion of Ramadan. And then after that, they killed, you know, went after the Israelis. There was candy handed out in the streets in Jerusalem and in East Jerusalem and other Palestinian towns in the West Bank. A bunch of other Arab states talked about how this was a wonderful event. So there is just a lot of hatred out there against the Israelis across the Middle East. Interestingly enough, there were the Saudi Arabians that actually came out and condemned this attack, which might speak to the warming relationship between Saudi Arabia and the Israelis. But looking forward to Ramadan, people are wondering whether this is going to be a bloody Ramadan. It lasts for a month. The Arabs are more whipped up in their mosques, incited by their religious leaders to perform harm on Jewish civilians. And then we see, looks like the Israelis, they pretty much shut down the West Bank, not letting any, especially over this weekend, any Palestinians come in from the West Bank into Israel proper, which will most likely make them even more upset and more willing to perform these atrocious acts on the Jews. But we'll see what happens next week. The terrorist attacks, they really do just continue over here in Israel.
Yeah, it's got to be a tough situation. You can see, yeah, they just get all this whipped up over them closing down borders. But yeah, how can you blame them for closing down borders when you keep having things like this happen across Tel Aviv and Jerusalem? But definitely thanks for bringing that story to us. Now moving over to another area of the world, in America, we have a big story that's not gotten a ton of media coverage. Obviously, any of our listeners who'd taken any mythology classes in history will probably remember the legend of the Greek warrior Achilles, who was supposed to have been an invincible warrior during the Trojan War, who could only be defeated if he was wounded in his heel. It was his only weak spot. Well, as the Trumpets reported for since 1995 at least, the American military has its own weak spot, its own Achilles heel. And to describe that more to us, we'll go over now to Richard.
Yes, we have an article in this Trumpet Weekly from Real Clear Defense that talks about just how vulnerable America is to cyber attack. And I think one of the things that this article does particularly well is it draws attention to the asymmetrical nature of the attack, to use a bit of jargon. Basically, cyber warfare computer systems, in a way, they're a bit like a tower built out of playing cards. It's much easier to go and knock somebody else's down than it is to protect your own. So there are probably millions of different computers or bits of IT systems within the U.S. that would be dangerous if they were compromised. For America to protect itself, it would have to keep every single one of those safe. Whereas for an enemy to hurt America, it would just need to compromise one. And so this article talks about how that this is an incredibly potent danger. It says that cyber attacks are not just a future threat, but something that the military faces on a daily basis. It talks also about intellectual property theft. They quote an expert saying logistics, command and control, fleet positioning, everything down to targeting all relies on software and other military internet-related technologies. And it goes through a few other things and concludes this is an astonishing liability underlying the most powerful military in the world.
Yeah, it is something we don't hear much coverage on. And I suppose people could argue that America could use techniques of cyber war against a rival, same as they could use it against us. But I think probably what they miss there is that a lot of foreign militaries, because they aren't as high tech, they actually have fighting techniques they've developed that don't rely so much on technology, where it seems like almost all America's plans are they're dependent on electronic communication systems and satellites. If those didn't function, we almost don't have a plan B.
That's right. And it says in this article, the cyber world is a great force equalizer that will surely be a significant factor in any future large-scale conflict. And the article, I don't think we put them in the Trumpet Weekly itself, but it did have quite a few statistics. So, for example, over 80% of U.S. government and military satellite communication travel over commercial satellites. So, as you said, America is just hugely dependent upon this, and it's on something that could very easily be compromised. And also, as you said, you're right, this isn't something, in some ways, this is a hard subject to kind of get in the news because it's not news in a way. I mean, like you said, we've been writing on this since the mid-90s. It's a 20-year-old story. And so it is hard to kind of get people excited about how vulnerable America is because it's always been there. And so it's very easy just to turn it off, to go to sleep on this issue. But as this brings out, there is just such a huge potential for danger here. And I think the fact that it's not been addressed, I mean, firstly, it shows how hard it is to address. Like we talked about, it's an asymmetrical threat. But I think it also just shows a certain lack of thinking at the top of the U.S. military. They're not concerned about the potential for being attacked. They're kind of thinking about fighting in terms of fighting a bunch of terrorists living in a cage, in a cave, rather than being concerned about an enemy that might launch a surprise attack, fighting a near peer or a powerful technological opponent.
Right. It is just such a strategic danger. And I definitely encourage all our listeners to look at our Trumpet Weekly report, which you can find on thetrumpet.com, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Like I said, we have an article in there that's summarized the big points of this news story in just a few hundred words, but then there's also, if you want online, like a hyperlink to the actual Real Clear Defense article itself, which is much longer than we had room for in our Trumpet Weekly, but it is just filled with a lot of shocking statistics on just how much of a vulnerability. It really is almost like an Achilles heel. It's, you look at America as this enormous military power that's just got this huge weak spot that is, like Richard said, an equalizer. So we definitely thank you for bringing that story to us and moving to another area of the world. The Trumpet has covered for last 3 years or so just the rise of China's military might in the South China Sea and their attempts to intimidate and dominate Southeast Asia. And another story we've covered since the mid-90s is their attempts to intimidate Taiwan. And so to give us a little bit more information on how the situation's developing between China and Taiwan this week, we'll turn to our Asian correspondent, Mr. Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the new government in Taiwan has been in power for just 2 weeks now, and it has wasted no time at all in defying China and pushing a really pro-independence agenda. This new government is led by President Tsai Ing-wen. She's the head of the Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, and she ran on a strong pro-independence platform and was elected in a landslide victory based on her promises to make Taiwan no longer submissive to China. And that victory happened on January 16th of this year. But the DPP didn't start ruling until just 2 weeks ago. And already, just in these 2 weeks, President Tsai has made two really bold moves to show China that things are now different and that Taiwan will not be taking the same path that the outgoing president, President Ma Ying-jeou, took. So the first major move involved high school textbooks. Under President Ma, Taiwan had adopted a set of high school textbooks that were extremely China-friendly and China-centric. Everything in these books was taught in accordance basically with China's worldview. The U.S. is evil, China is the savior of the world, Russia is a wonderful nation, China owns the entire South China Sea and the Senkaku Islands and half of the world, Taiwan is essentially a part of China, etc. Dictatorial governments love to create textbooks like this because they can use them to indoctrinate young minds into believing whatever they want those young minds to believe, and then all of those young minds will essentially support that government and thereby make it more powerful. So China was very happy with these textbooks, which to a degree indoctrinated the young Taiwanese students with a very China-friendly view of the world. But then, just a week after becoming president, on June 1st, Tsai Ing-wen said, no, we are not using those books anymore. They're too China-friendly. They're too submissive to China, and we're not playing that game anymore. So she abolished those books. The people of Taiwan were overjoyed at it. Many of them had protested the previous China-friendly textbooks. One student protester even died in some of those protests. So it got pretty heated for a little while there. But now those people are overjoyed at having those textbooks done away with, and it really represents what I think is a growing pro-independence push in China. Anyway, the second move by this new Taiwanese government happened just this week, on the day of June 4th. The ears of China watchers should prick up at the mention of June 4th, because that was the day back in 1989 that the Chinese Communist Party authored a savage crackdown on student protesters there in Tiananmen Square. Those were anti-government protests, and the Chinese Communist Party did not wait around to see if the protests would die down. They didn't decide to negotiate with the protesters or promise reforms. Instead of any of that, they deployed a convoy of tanks and troops to break those up. And Beijing has never released a death toll, but estimates from human rights groups say that anywhere from several hundred to several thousand people died in that crackdown. And it's a subject that remains very taboo in China. It's just not something that people are free to talk about, especially since China's current president, President Xi Jinping, is now overseeing a broad crackdown of his own on rights groups and activists. Well, on June 4th of this year, the 27th anniversary of that shameful history, the Taiwanese president took to Facebook to send President Xi Jinping a message. And the message basically told him not to fear democracy and that China should look to Taiwan as an example of how to have an effective but fair government. And just a message that President Xi would be really wrathful at seeing. So the reason all of this is significant is because it's just the opposite of what the previous government in Taiwan did for the last 8 years. During those 8 years, President Ma was just really submissive to China, and China got used to having Taiwan submit to it and do pretty much whatever China said. So now the question is, how long will Beijing tolerate this new government that is far less cooperative, far less submissive? And so it's possible that the DPP under President Tsai might eventually acknowledge that they have to be more submissive to China. They can't rely on the U.S. the way they used to. Or if the DPP and President Tsai continue this hardline stance, then it really could prompt Beijing to take some drastic action to possibly swallow Taiwan up.
Right. It's tragic in that they just can't seem to win for losing over there. They don't have the military might to oppose China. They're very dependent on their alliance with the United States, which for the past three presidential administrations, we haven't really wanted to jeopardize our relations with Beijing to defend Taiwan. I mean, we do owe them $1 trillion.
But yeah, it puts us in a tight spot.
But in Taiwan's case, I mean, you can have like the previous president where they're a softliner and they just slowly get absorbed into China, or the current president who's a hardliner and they get absorbed into China more violently. But it seems like without an America that's willing to defend our allies one way or another, they're going back towards Beijing.
It's a volatile situation. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, well, definitely thanks for bringing that to us. You've been listening to The Trumpet Hour at 101.3 KPCG. We'll have one more story here right before our lightning round. This is actually about the only story today you've probably heard a little bit already from the mainstream media on the American primaries, and how candidate Hillary Clinton now has enough delegates to clinch the Democratic nomination, unless something drastic changes between now and the convention. But to give us a little news on the Bernie Sanders campaign and how that's shaping American politics, we'll turn to, since Mr. Sanders was educated at a college in Chicago. We've brought on our own Chicago native to give us a little bit of insights into the really messed up politics of that city. And we'll turn to Mr. Sam Livingston.
Thank you. As many people already know, Hillary Clinton this week clinched the number of delegates needed to be the Democratic presidential nominee. So, as some have joked, every American voter this November will be forced to make the second worst decision of their lives. But unlike in the Republican Party, where Donald Trump got the number of delegates he needed, and Ted Cruz and John Kasich quickly dropped out of the race, Bernie Sanders will not give up. He says that the struggle will continue. He doesn't want to go away. He will keep fighting until the end of July when they hold their Democratic convention in Philadelphia and settle on who the candidate will be. And many are wondering, well, what is he doing? Why would you do this? Now, pretty much the only issue that I think the Democratic Party can agree on is that they do not want Donald Trump to be president. So everyone's saying Hillary Clinton has the number of delegates she needs. Why wouldn't you just drop out, go ahead and support her? You continue to run a campaign, which is expensive. You're traveling around speaking, spending all of this money, what is essentially looked at as a lost cause. So there's probably something more pressing in Bernie Sanders' mind, and that's that he needs to keep his socialist agenda in the limelight. He doesn't want to burn out. Don't excuse the pun intended. He wants to keep going. He wants people to know, listen, socialism is here. He's got almost half of that party supporting him. And he wants to keep pushing ahead until he gets to this convention in Philadelphia where they finally settle on who the candidate is going to be. Now, when it gets into deciding that who the candidate will be, you have the system of delegates. There's regular delegates. Those are kind of lower level, and there's thousands of them, a lot more. And then there's these super delegates, and they're more of the elite, you could say, of the Democratic Party. Big donors, former politicians, they form more or less just the core of what this party is about. So he wants to go to the Philadelphia convention, and he wants to try to convince more of them, the undecided superdelegates, to side with him. He really wants to make an impact on the Democratic Party. When you look at the numbers here, Hillary Clinton has 577 of these superdelegates. Bernie Sanders has only 48. So he's got a lot of ground to make up in terms of really shaping what this party is about. He has that grassroots movement. When it comes to just regular delegates, he's really not that far behind Hillary Clinton. So he's pushing ahead. He's spending all this money. And probably defeating Donald Trump isn't the most important thing on his mind. It's probably we need to continue keeping this socialist agenda in the limelight. We need to make sure that this is more entrenched in this Democratic Party. And he believes that he can do that by waiting it out, spending this money over the next month and a half, and then finally getting to that convention where he can win over some more of those superdelegates. And probably he isn't going to win this election, but he has definitely changed what that party is about, the image that they portray, as you've written recently in The Trumpet, Mr. Miller, just about how influential he has been in this Democratic Party.
Definitely. Thanks for bringing that to us. And that is really kind of the other big thing is, like you said, he probably won't win this nomination. But the other thing they do at those conventions, then pick a candidate, is they also write their platform, which is basically like their party manifesto for the next administration. And if he can keep his ideology going right up into the convention, even if he doesn't get office, he can get a lot of his ideas enshrined in the text of that manifesto, which will influence the Democratic Party from here on forward. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive your free subscription of our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories are there, and we'll finish up our program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines that caught our attention this week. And to start us off, we'll go to Brent.
With the Obama administration having effectively given up on negotiating a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians, France tried its hand last Friday on making Middle East peace. They had a massive convention in Paris with a bunch of heads of state and secretaries of state and foreign ministers. And yet, after the day, after the three-hour meeting, they had little to show for their efforts, just a pretty mundane statement on how they affirm or reaffirm the two-state solution, which pretty much everybody agrees with. However, what the conference did do was show how the French are trying to fill the void in the Middle East peace process created by America's retreat. And this is certainly something we look forward or are looking forward to seeing, really, as Europe does try to take that mantle away from the United States.
Definitely a trend to keep watching. And next we'll go to Richard.
NATO is holding its biggest military exercises since the Cold War. It will see German tanks return to Poland for the first time since the end of World War II. In the Trumpet Weekly, we have an article from the New York Times on a similar subject called In a Reversal, Germany's Military Growth is Met with Western Relief. And in there, it talks about how both throughout Europe and the world, and also within German leaders themselves, people are, quote, finally growing more comfortable with the notion that Germany's role as the European Union's de facto leader requires a military dimension.
All right, and now to Jeremiah.
China has sent one of its warships to the waters off the Senkaku Islands, which are in the East China Sea and are controlled by Japan. Now, China, as you would expect, disputes Japan's control of those islands and says that China is the rightful owner. The Chinese have often sent non-military vessels to that area just to ensure that Japan remembers that China has not relinquished those claims. But this time, the Chinese sent a warship, a very significant escalation. And in an interesting twist, two Russian vessels were also seen in the Senkaku's contiguous zone at the same time. It's unclear whether or not the Chinese and the Russians were working together, but either way, the Japanese are both furious and frightened by this development.
That sea just keeps heating up. And now we'll, for next lightning round, we'll back to Richard.
Guy Verhofstadt, he's one of the top members of the European Parliament and he's former Belgian Prime Minister. He made some really good points about Britain's place in the European Union with the upcoming Brexit referendum in an interview with the EU Observer published this week. To quote from that article, either the British stay in the EU, but let the rest of it become a real union because they've now negotiated a bunch of opt-outs, he explained, or it exits the EU, letting it become a real union. So the way he sees it and the way many see it, the European Union is going to really move forward and integrate after the Brexit referendum, whatever happens.
Big event coming up next month. So we'll now, next item, we'll go to Sam.
The United States Bureau of Labor Statistics released their stats this week for the month of May. Job growth was pitiful. Only 38,000 new jobs added, while 664,000 dropped out of the labor force altogether. That pushes the total number of people not in the labor force in the United States up to a record 94.7 million.
All right, and we'll finish off with one last one today with Richard.
The French defense minister on Sunday called on European navies to have a, quote, regular and visible presence within the South China Sea to uphold the freedom of navigation. So it's looking like there could be a European-wide response to what China is doing and what Jeremiah talks about over in the South China Sea. And it could see European navies and European militaries working together much more in order to respond to China.
All right. Thanks for bringing those to us, guys. I'm Andrew Miller, subbing in as host of the Trumpet Hour for Joel Hilliker. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com, and we'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories are in this week's edition. Tell us what you think about the programming by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panelists, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Sam Livingston.
Great to be with you.
Great to be here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with the words of Abraham Lincoln. America will never be destroyed from outside. If we falter and lose our freedoms, it'll be because we destroyed ourselves. Thank you for joining us at the Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.